Welcome to All About Agatha, the podcast dedicated to reading and ranking every single mystery novel written by the queen of crime, Dame Agatha Christie. I am Kemper Donovan, and boy, do I have an interview for you, listeners. I'm not going to belabor the point. Today you will be listening to my interview with the scholar Allison Light, and you will learn a whole lot more about her in just a moment. So I am going to take you to that interview right now. I've been looking forward to speaking with Allison Light for a while now, actually. Allison is a writer, critic, teacher, and scholar who was first published in the iconic feminist magazine Spare Rib, which I believe it wouldn't be incorrect for me to compare to Ms. Magazine over here on the American side of the pond. I think Spare Rib is a much better title, though. She was also a member of the editorial collective Feminist Review, through which she published her much-anthologized 1984 article, Returning to Manderley, Romance Fiction, Female Sexuality, and Class. And honestly, if we had unlimited time, I would insist on talking about this article, since Daphne du Maurier has a habit of intruding upon this Agatha Christie podcast from time to time. My former co-host Catherine and I even did a Rebecca deep dive on our Patreon account not too long ago. But moving along, Allison's first book is the one we'll be discussing in this episode. It's titled Forever England, Femininity, Literature, and Conservatism Between the Wars, one whole chapter of which is dedicated to Agatha Christie. That chapter is titled Agatha Christie and Conservative Modernity, and this book was published in 1991. So more on that in just a moment. But just to give a little bit of background on Allison before we get into our conversation, she has published four other books to date, including the 2019 memoir, A Radical Romance, which won the UK's Pen Ackerley Prize. She is a regular contributor to the London Review of Books and has written for The Guardian, The New Statesman, and The Times Literary Supplement, among other publications. She is a fellow of the British Academy, the Royal Society of Literature, and the Royal Historical Society. She's currently an honorary professor in the Department of English at University College London, and an honorary professorial fellow in the Department of English Literature at Edinburgh University. She's also a senior research fellow at Pembroke College in Oxford. And I should also mention that Allison's most recent publication is a collection of essays titled Inside History from Popular Fiction to Life Writing. Currently, it's only available in hardcover, and it's a bit pricey, but I believe there will be a more reasonably priced paperback coming out soon. And happily, her Returning to Manderley piece is part of that collection. I was actually perusing the table of contents, and there were lots of juicy titles that jumped out at me, referencing The Color Purple and Great Expectations, though unquestionably the best of all is A Wolf in Dog's Clothing, Flush. That, of course, is Wolf with two O's, since the reference is to Virginia Woolf's doggy book. Her biography of Elizabeth Barrett Browning's Cocker Spaniel Flush. Christie, of course, wrote a doggy book herself, so I just like to keep tabs on the subgenre of doggy literature. Anyway, I'm very much looking forward to checking out that collection, and I'd like to welcome you, Allison, and thank you for taking the time to chat with me today.
Thank you, Kemper, and thanks for that wonderful introduction. It makes me sound thoroughly obnoxious, I think. To reassure your listeners that I'm not.
Accomplished, never obnoxious.
English irony, yeah.
So I know that I just said I wasn't going to talk about your Returning to Manderley article, but you have a great summation in that piece of what I took to be your main point. And I think it might be worthwhile to apply that point to detective fiction, because I think it gets at a lot of what you're saying in Forever England. So bear with me a moment. Here's the quote. That women read romance fiction is, I think, as much a measure of their deep dissatisfaction with heterosexual options as of any desire to be fully identified with the submissive versions of femininity the texts endorse. Romance imagines peace, security, and ease precisely because there is dissension, insecurity, and difficulty. In other words, it's not like women read romance fiction thinking this is the way the world works. They read it because they know this is not the way the world works. So if I just make a few substitutions, I can alter the statement as follows. That people read Agatha Christie is, I think, as much a measure of their deep anxiety over the unknowability of their neighbors and perhaps even their family members as it is any desire to be fully identified with the stock character types the texts endorse. Christie's fiction imagines clarity, closure, and comeuppance precisely because there is confusion, irresolution, and injustice. Would you agree with my cut and paste job here, cribbing from your essay about romance fiction and applying it to Christie?
Yeah, I mean, up to a point, I think that's true of most detective fiction that is, if you like, basically a puzzle, you know, where the detective finds out the truth and establishes it. It's rather like what W.H. Auden said in his famous essay about, which called The Guilty Vicarage. You know, the order's restored because, in fact, life isn't like that. Yeah, what I would add to it, Kemper, is that I think there's a very particular moment that Christie's also writing to, which was the sort of British scene, and in particular the English scene, between the wars after the horrors of the First World War, when actually there's a huge amount of social mobility within people who, you know, we would broadly have called middle class here. A lot of people moving around, a lot of incomers into the villages, new housing estates, new suburbs, a lot of building projects. People weren't what they seemed anymore, you know. So I think while it's also true that as a genre, crime fiction of Christie's sort, if there is a sort, does restore that sense of peace and harmony, I think it also spoke, the historian in me wants to say it spoke to a very particular cultural moment.
Yeah, I think that's true. And it's funny because I always point to, on this podcast, books such as A Murder is Announced, which was written after World War II, because she has this run of post-World War II books in which she makes a lot of the notion that, oh, well, these, you know, nowadays neighbors don't know each other and people can just come into a town and they used to come with letters, right? Like actually with letters from people who they might have known in common who could recommend them. And that's just been completely done away with. And, you know, this is some part of the changing post-World War II landscape. But in reading Forever England, I think you have textual proof for the fact that that's not just a 1950s thing that Christie does, because you're very specifically dealing with Christie in the 30s in Forever England.
And, that's right.
Right.
I mean, if you remember the murder of Roger Ackroyd, of course you remember it, but if you think about the murder of Roger Ackroyd, nobody in that book, nobody in that novel is what they seem. You know, Ackroyd is only playing at being a squire. The Ferrers, who appear the sort of slightly more upmarket family who've settled at the big house, they've only just arrived. Mm-hmm. The maid is actually a lady in disguise. The colonel, who is the sort of pucker sahib, has never actually been in the Shanghai club. And even the gentleman next door at the Larches, who's doing his marrows, turns out to be Hercule Poirot. You know, so Christie really enjoys, I think, troubling her contemporary readers, and that's where she's so different from the pre-war detective writers and some of her own fellows like Dorothy L. Sayers, for instance, for whom villages, you know, Sayers wants to believe, I think it's a fantasy, but she wants to believe everybody's still in their place, you know, and that the lower orders are where they should be and the toffs are in charge. Mm-hmm. I should add that I love some of Dorothy L. Sayers' novels, but they are of a very different ilk, if I can use that word, from Christie, who has a much more democratic imagination, I think.
It's true. Yeah, it's not just, I think most people talk about the quality of the writing being so different because Sayers is so much more, I guess we could say, bountiful or descriptive in the way that she writes, and Christie is so lean. But it's not just about writing style. It really is about what preoccupies them. And I think that's absolutely right. And I love that you also bring up in Forever England the Sidiford mystery, which features a lot of tenants, as Christie tends to do. You make that point a few times, and I had never thought about that. that a lot of people in Christie are not staying in the place where they're living for very long. They haven't been there very long, and they may be leaving very soon. And you even bring up the mousetrap. You know, what's more iconic than the mousetrap when it comes to Agatha Christie? That's a guest house. I mean, they're just staying there for a number of days. These are not people who are rooted to the land, you know, upon which they live.
No, that's right. I mean, I think I'm right in saying that over here, she's very much and in the recent adaptation, she's very much associated with the village and kind of turned into a heritage sort of figure. But actually, only about a quarter of the novels are set in villages for a start. And of course, the great metaphor for her is travel. You know, trains and boats and planes, exotic locations, tourism, and the great expansion of travel for people in the interwar years, which meant that all kinds of people and not just sort of empire explorers and lone male figures could get on a plane, you know, from Croydon Airport. So she not only expands the clientele in her novels to include, you know, fairly humble characters like dentists and nurses and receptionists, but also she takes them to places like Baghdad or Mesopotamia. You know, these are, she's not a settled writer. And we know, of course, and I'm sure you've talked about, you know, her own life was one of great unsettlement, particularly through her second husband, Max Malone, who was an archaeologist.
Absolutely. And I think I never quite made the connection, but I do think that Christie sets a lot of her novels abroad or on holiday. And the point is not necessarily where these people are. The point is not to explore a foreign land per se. The point is that they are in a temporary setting, right? Like, it's another way, I think, right, of placing them in a setting where they're going to leave and where people are on shifting sands, right? And they don't know necessarily who is who and who, what, you know, what people's motives are. And that is, you know, part of the, you know, the point you make in your book is that this is part of being in the middle class, right? The quote unquote middle class, especially in those interwar periods. And she's making a lot of this and doing it in a light and entertaining way. Whereas some of the more quote unquote literary authors at the time were doing it in a much heavier and darker way, but doing it nonetheless and, you know, making much of it. I mean, the one thing, it has constantly bedeviled us, I think, on this podcast. There are certain times when the fact that I and also my late co-host, Catherine, we are both American and we are talking about a British, not just a British and English author. And you, it strikes me that you are actually probably one of the most qualified people to answer this question, because when we talk about middle class in the United States, that is a totally different thing from what middle class means to someone from Britain. So when you speak of the quote unquote middle class in the interwar period, what exactly does that mean?
I think it's more helpful to talk about the middle classes. For a start, and having been in the States a fair bit, I'm not entirely convinced, you know, that the middle classes don't exist, you know, in the same kind of way, just to put that out there, because I think it's a relationship. It's helpful. I mean, you know, the British and the English always accused of being obsessed with class. And I think it's very important in this particular instance, because I think Christie plays with a lot of that, as you said. So it's not just importing it, as it were, into the text. But I think the thing that defines the middle classes is that they're in the middle. So they dissociate themselves from the lower orders, who would largely be, particularly if you're women, servants, people who look after, and the blue-collar people, you might say. But certainly, you know, Christie's not very interested in those people. She's not condescending or snobbish at all. But she's, you know, they're not that interesting. They're sometimes figures of pathos. But equally, she's not interested in the aristocrats. You know, they don't really feature. And she's not in love with a lord like Dorothy Alsayers. It's this broad band of people in between. And in terms of defining it, you know, how many heads has the Hydra got? It's almost impossible, in that it's to do with notions of respectability and of in some cases, you know, the older professions, doctors, clergymen, lawyers, and so on, which were rapidly being replaced in Britain in this period after the First World War and before, by new occupations, you know, and by women going into jobs, by the expansion of business, you know, businessmen crop up in her novels. Different kinds of respectability that, you know, the older English weren't so secure around. And she's able to play with that and manipulate those anxieties, you know, is this person what they seem? And I think one of the great things about the English middle class is, I mean, I spent my life trying to understand who the hell they are. You know, it was in a way where Forever England came from. It was me trying to make sense of people's assumptions and habits. You know, there's a kind of Anglicanism that was very mystifying to me, which is a sort of conservatism with a small c, where you don't rock the boat too much. A sort of reticence and reserve, which was coming as I did from a very loud working class family, was very alien. You know, I learned not to speak so loud. It's probably why I loved Americans, you know, they always made me feel normal. So there were lots of different ways in which you could define it, but I guess for our purposes, one of the most important things is that it's a heterogeneous group of people who all think that they're not working class and they're not aristocrats and they're constantly policing their own boundaries. You know, they're constantly worried about their own respectability. I'm sure you have an American version of that. You might not call it respectability, but, you know, it's to do with sort of, in this period anyway, it's very much to do with domestic life, with favouring a quiet life, with a private life. You know, privacy is very important. It's very important to Agatha Christie, who, as you know, barely revealed anything about herself.
Yeah.
The whole notion of a life that sort of looks inward, that wants peace and quiet, you know, that's a very English notion, I think, very much of this period. You know, it's the same period in which George Orwell, in a very famous essay called Inside the Whale, talks about the English, you know, loving their cricket and warm beer and pottering around in the garden. And, you know, that still speaks to me. You know, it sort of strikes something in me, even though nobody in my family ever played cricket. you know, so it's sort of each version of that. And I think it's still around today. You know, I don't think class is a thing. I think it's a relationship, if that helps.
No, that does help. I mean, it almost seems to me, and we are talking about what the middle classes meant in that period too. It seems to me it's almost defined by its unsettled aspect, given this element of fixity, if you will, on either end of it, right? In the terms of the working class, who were the servant class, who were, you know, sort of, well, that is my station, that is,
trade class. Most middle class people had almost no knowledge. I mean, this is probably still true to some extent, of how the other halves lived, as it were. And they would only come into contact with, you know, lower class people through trade, you know, through having their groceries delivered, or through their maidservant, or the coal being delivered, or whatever it was. I mean, one thing I think I would add, which we haven't said, is that the element of domestication in Christie, what's one of the things that's so brilliant about her, how she domesticates the story, is by using all these family, it's very family oriented, I should perhaps say that too often, but she uses all these domestic objects, you know, to murder people with, you know, like the
tennis racket,
kind of tennis racket with a steel ball at the end of it, or a cricket ball in a sock, or the pus from a cat's ear, you know, from the wound in a cat's ear. So it's both looking inwards into the home, into what ought to be these nice settled families, and then looking at all the potential murderousness that actually is in families. And I think that's why people like Patricia Highsmith and Hitchcock loved her so much, you know, because they could take those elements and lift that out. And I think that idea that, you know, your husband might be a murderer is far more frightening. Those who like the gothic elements in Christie, far more frightening than some unknown pathological killer.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. You know, I'll quote you again, because even when you're just sort of at the outset in Forever England, before you're getting into any of your arguments, you know, you define this interwar period that is going to be under consideration, you know, over the course of the whole book. And you say that it's easily seen from the masculine point of view as a kind of hiatus in history, right? An interval sandwiched between more dramatic and more historically significant acts. But in fact, there was actually a lot going on. And I'll quote from you again, new kinds of social and personal opportunity were offered by the changing cultures of sport and entertainment, from tennis clubs to cinema going, new forms of spending which higher purchase made possible, new forms of household appliance, new attitudes to housework. And it's funny, but one thing I've noticed in my close reading of Christie is that aside from her quite lively engagement with domesticity, which is absolutely there in book after book, she has a real affection, not just even for families, but for the practice of homemaking. Yes. She really does mention higher purchase in multiple texts. And the reason I remember it is that I had to look up what HP was, because that's how she uses the acronym. And for me, as a Californian, I thought, is that Hewlett-Packard? Well, of course it's not, because she can't be. And I was like, what is HP? How could she be on an, you know, a sort of initialism basis with this thing? I don't even know what it is. And it was higher purchase, and it comes up a bit. And, you know, especially even in the later books, she talks about vacuum cleaners and other sorts of innovations. And it shows through in her autobiography when she talks about even the servants who she grew up with and how they were experts at what they did, and her fascination with that, with sort of like their craft and just the art of domesticity. And I think that is absolutely true. And of course, then when you're bringing murder into that, that is a very frightening and sort of visceral thing. And that's a big part of what she does so well. And what, I mean, I think it's true. You know, you already mentioned both her contemporaries like Dorothy Sayers and then the film and television adaptations of her books, both of which tend to, I don't even want to say watered down, but mischaracterized, I think, a lot of her true preoccupations in the text. I think we should lay the blame both at the door of contemporaries who might have had slightly different preoccupations, but then also on the adaptations. And I actually would love to quote you one more time, because you have this great line as to what the adaptations do. And I'll be brief, because I've also made this point approximately a billion times on the podcast about the fact that the adaptations have compressed Christie's oeuvre.
So many things I want to say. I can't get a word in edgeways. Carry on.
Sorry. Go ahead. People want to hear from you, not me.
No. I mean, there are too many things flying past. I mean, I think one of the things I'd like to say about the adaptations, again, would be from the historian's point of view, wearing that hat, which is that they reflect very much the concerns of the day. That's one thing, you know, of the 80s adaptations, you know, which by then Christie was becoming a sort of, you know, a kind of House of the Parliament. She was becoming a kind of symbol, really, of some imagined past of long, and she suffered from that. But what the adaptations also do is reimagine her, and good luck to them. You know, they also see things freshly and make you look at the text freshly. You know, there's a positive side to that. But one of the things they all do is turn her into pictures, and that brings with it, you know, so many different ways of thinking and seeing. I mean, you know, I started off thinking about her books as what I called the literature of convalescence, after the very bloody experiences of the First War, you know, when people really didn't want to read about violence. And, you know, this was the era for the British of the crossword puzzle and the jigsaw. You know, all these things were invented then. And I think probably by Americans and then brought over. But it's like, you know, reading a Christie novel, which can be quite a, is a very pleasurable rather than usually an upsetting experience, although there are exceptions. But generally, you know, the pleasure of it is the kind of figuring out, is a distance to some extent from the violence. You don't feel upset by the violence, as that's not what they're doing. I think once you start to film and make, you know, television programs, you've got a bit of a problem because the camera's already a distance. And, you know, as you know, television and film, anything visual has to keep it visually interesting. Mm-hmm. So inevitably you're substituting pictures that, you know, you're putting in pictures that aren't there in the text, you know, like country houses, which are not described in any detail at all in Christie's fiction. She's not interested in them. But you get a fair bit of property porn in the adaptations. But equally, I think the new adaptations by Sarah Phelps, they play up the gothic elements, I think, in Christie, which are there. But what they can't do is the humour. And one of the great delights of Christie, I think, is the pleasure and the playfulness. And that belongs, again, very much to her period. I was thinking, I first read Agatha Christie when I was about 13 or 14, and I was being very bullied at school. I was having a rotten time, and my mum was in hospital, and I discovered Christie. And at the same time, I discovered P.G. Woodhouse, you know, who wrote the Jeeves novels, and Christie and Woodhouse were mutual fans. They both liked each other's work. And it, you know, it was for the escape, if you like, into these wonderful, complex, but not ultimately threatening puzzles, you know, that I valued the books, but also for the kind of celebration of ordinary life which she offered with her characters. Mm-hmm. So I think that's also sort of its time. And I think there's a lot more impatience now with the fun side of Christie. You know, she started off with a lot more of that kind of 20s fizz than perhaps we can deal with now. You know, they're shown as much darker. I mean, I think someone like David Suchet in the Poirot adaptations just always managed to keep that edge of parody and self-mocking that's there in the Poirot novels. He managed to keep that alive without going too far with it, and did it beautifully, actually.
Yeah, I think especially in the earlier seasons, the series, yeah, you know, descended into a darker tone, yeah, I think, as it went on. Yeah. And I think that was almost then reflective of what the BBC went on to do when they licensed a bunch of those big titles out and Sarah Phelps adapted them. I mean, my way of expressing what I think Sarah Phelps does is that Christie, in her some of her Miss Marple novels, likes to make fun of serious, yeah, quote-unquote literary authors, with Miss Marple's nephew, Raymond, yes, West, who, yes, likes to write, yes, about serious,
yeah, exactly,
things.
And, yeah, yeah,
he,
yeah,
doesn't have a, you know, an iota, yeah, of humor in him. And to me, sometimes it feels as though those Sarah Phelps adaptations are written by Raymond West.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think Christie would probably roll
her. That wonderful self-parody, you know, the novelist, what's her name, you know?
Ariadne Oliver.
Yeah, yes, exactly. Who's always, yes, eating apples like Christie did.
Absolutely.
You know, so in that way, she's very frustrating, I think, to people who want to adapt her. I mean, that's the other problem with, say, like the film of Murder on the Orient Express, because, as you said, the point, in a way, of putting them all on the train is that they could be anywhere. Mm-hmm. It's a closed circle. You know, it could be a hotel. With the door, it's a locked crime murderer. And what you discover, and I can't think there's anybody out there who hasn't read or seen Murder on the Orient Express, is that the people who appear strangers are related. And that, you know, that's a common theme in Christie. But what the film has to do is play up all the foreignness, and it distracts you, actually, from the plot, mm-hmm, which ends up, much as I have enjoyed the different films, you know, the plot ends up looking a bit preposterous, whereas when you're reading it, it doesn't feel like that.
Absolutely. By the way, the line in your book when you're talking, yeah, about the adaptations, and this is a book written in 1991, so I think mainly you're responding to the BBC's Joan Hickson adaptation,
yes,
at that point, but you say that they're responsible for homogenizing half a century of novels into a timeless mulch. I just love the phrase a timeless mulch, because I think it's so perfect, because a mulch is not the worst thing ever. I mean, a mulch can support quite a bit of life, right? But it's still a,
yes,
mulch.
Yes, and I should add that I still think Joan Hickson is the best Miss Marple ever.
Yeah.
I think she really always did capture both the steeliness and the deceptively kind of flutteriness, if that's the word, the deceptive, mm-hmm, spinstery flutteriness of Miss Marple. But, you know, she has that look. She convinces you that she's an intellect, which is a very hard thing for people playing dotty old ladies to do.
Yes.
So, you know, I do feel she achieved something despite some of the less admirable moments in the adaptations.
Agreed. Yeah, those adaptations are not perfect. It's eye-opening watching them from a distance because their production quality issues. And then even as you say, and you had written this article around the time, I think Forever England was published, and talking about the Nemesis adaptation in particular, and we just recently covered Nemesis, but you know, the way that they do this sort of English heritage thing, and they focus on the houses, and they even set a murder, you know, a murder that takes place outside, and quite infamously and a bit ridiculously on, you know, of a rolling boulder down a hilltop, that's turned into literally a bust of Shakespeare in a library. And, you know, just the tethering of the story to country houses and old England and whatnot that series sometimes did, which didn't necessarily always service the story. But,
and yet amazingly, having rewatched some of those, you know, Christie transcends that because the plots are still good enough, surprising enough, and she's still free enough of a lot of the snobbery that, you know, you find in other detective writers, and indeed the kind of aggression that you get in the hard-boiled school. You know, there's enough there, I think. Like all very good writers, and I think she was a very good writer, obviously. She didn't need me to say it, but, you know, she can be done a million ways. You know, she can be reread, and she'll no doubt go on being reversioned and reimagined, you know, for the rest of our lifetimes. I can't see that stopping. And it's very interesting what people find in her.
Don't touch that dial. We'll be back in a moment with the rest of our episode. We just wanted to take a moment to ask you, our dear listeners, for a favor.
If you haven't already done so, we would very much appreciate it if you take a moment to, you know, give us a rating or a review wherever you're listening to this podcast.
It really helps the podcast out because ratings and reviews make it much easier for other Christie fans such as yourselves to find our podcast.
And the more ratings and reviews we get, the more people we can reach.
It should take you a matter of seconds, and lucky you, we're going to provide you with those seconds right now, so go to it.
Thank you so much. And now, back to our regularly scheduled programming.
So I think what I found to be one of your most interesting and ultimately convincing arguments in Forever England was the idea that many of these so-called failings of Christie's stories, you know, we were just talking about how she actually is an excellent writer, and I'll quote you again on what these so-called failings are. The emptying of moral and social effect, the evacuating of notions of character, the transparency of the prose appear in a different light when we think of Christie not as a stodgy writer who's carrying on a Victorian or Edwardian tradition, but instead as a modernist, because what's really to stop us from perceiving all those supposed failings as modernist innovations, right? And I love...
Yes, good point. I'd like you to hold on to the other half of the argument.
Sure.
Yes, I think that's... Obviously, you're quoting me, so I kind of agree. But not to the point of disorienting people finally and ultimately, you know, whereas the modernists would look at the unsettled, the alienated, the traumatic in family life, would play with narrative, might make a narrator very unstable and even a murderer, they would leave you with those feelings and with that literary experiment. I think, you know, the art of Christie is to then resolve so much of that. And I think that's where what I call her conservatism, with a small c, the conservatism that maybe we all have, you know, is the comforting side of Christie. I mean, I just was looking at Forever England to remind myself of the person who wrote it. And If I can, I'll quote you a bit from They Came to Baghdad, which has this very ordinary person, Victoria Jones, which is about the most English name you could come up with, although Jones is actually Welsh. And she's musing on prehistoric finds in the Middle East and basically sees, you know, it could be the home counties, it could be somewhere in England, really, because she says life's all the same, really, isn't it? Those were the things that mattered, the little everyday things, the family to be cooked for, the four walls that enclosed the home, the one or two cherished possessions, all the thousands of ordinary people on the earth, minding their own business and tilling that earth, making pots, bringing up families, laughing and crying and getting up in the morning and going to bed at night. They were the people who mattered. And, you know, it's kind of as close to a manifesto in a way as Christy comes. It's, you know, a celebration of that ongoing, ordinary kind of life. There's something also very English about that, too. I recognise it, you know, in my own mother, who came from a very different world. But, you know, that what you want to be left alone, just to get on with your life. I mean, I'm sure it's what a lot of people are feeling now, you know, when they look at the terrible things that are going on in the world. That those are the things that matter. But it is also a sort of retreat. And in that period, it's a retreat, you know, as always, from politics, from the world, from the things that, you know, sometimes one has to pay attention to and that you can't avoid. So I think the phrase I used in the book is, not just for Christy, but of the other writers I look at, is conservative modernity. Mm-hmm. And I think women in particular in that period embodied that. You know, they were in reaction against their Victorian upbringing, and they were emancipated in so many ways. But equally, you know, they were holding, particularly these women of the so-called middle classes, they were, you know, they didn't want to go too far. They wanted the domestic, the quiet life. It's the tension. Maybe it's the tension in everybody.
Yeah, well, a few things. I loved that you quoted from They Came to Baghdad in your book, the quote that you just read out, because I had just recently made reference to that specific passage in the book, which that is, by the way, you know, we have this ongoing project on this podcast of ranking all 66 of Christy's books. That book is ranked very low, as most of the thrillers are, but that moment in that book shines through. It really does. And it has stuck with me. It is now years since I reread the book for the podcast, but you can feel almost the, you know, the passion or the belief that she infuses in that passage, that she really, that is what she truly believes. And she gets at that again, which you bring up in your book. She gets at that again in Come Tell Me How You Live, you know, her first autobiographical writing, and you can feel that is how she wants to live her life, and that is her ethos, I guess we could say. And it is very English. I mean, it reminds me a little bit even of Tolkien, believe it or not.
At the
end of Lord of the Rings, this huge adventure, and then he just goes
home.
And you go back to the little hobbit home. And that's what everything is worth. And, you know, by the way, Tolkien is almost an exact contemporary of Christy, because I had that thought as I was preparing for this, and I was like, when was Tolkien around? Yeah. It was like 1892 to 1973, Christy's 1890 to 1976. Both very English.
Very English in a particular, you know, because, you know, without wanting to put on boots and stamp all over this, you know, there's so many people for whom that wasn't possible in Christie's England, let alone in other countries that the British were, of course, dominating still or attempting to hold on to. But it's the 1951, I think, you know, They Came to Baghdad. So it's after the war. After the Second War, I should say, you know, 1945 was the great spirit of change in Britain, the beginning of a welfare state, of the National Health Service, of the working classes, you know, getting a say, if you like, in national life. So it's a wonderful, moving statement, but it's also quite backward-looking by that time. I can say that. It doesn't make me like it less, but it makes me, you know, I feel the tug of it, and I think, you know, what is it about the English? You know, here we are, I'm sitting here in one of those typical, what you would call a row house and we call a terrace street. You know, you see them all over Britain. I grew up in one. I've lived in so many because it was the most common form of 19th century houses. And we all love our individual houses. And we all love kind of the domesticity. And it's something that's very, you know, it's not our contemporaries in France and Germany live very happily in apartments. But the British still hate all of that, you know, to a certain extent.
Well, you need your gardens, right? The British need
gardens. That's the other thing, gardens, yes. I mean, my husband, whose parents were Irish, are both gone now, but, you know, when we go over to Ireland, I'm always amazed, as I am in the US, by the lack of gardens. You know, you sort of sit your houses in these big open spaces. And I think, how can you bear it? Why haven't you got a fence? You know, so it's that's what I call conservatism with a small c, everything fenced off and inward looking.
Right.
You know? That's the other side of it, psychologically, if you like. And what she does is unsettle that for her readers and open that out and then, of course, close it down again at the end.
Right. And I have so much appreciation for that because I think there's a deft touch there to what she's doing and a lot of nuance. I mean, I love the example that you bring up for how she does a little bit of this unsettling. And I think this is revealing as to the conservative modernity that you're talking about that Christie exemplifies. You make the point that Christie has her sidekick Hastings, right? And Hastings is a stooge. Yeah. But this is a slight tweak of the Watson-Sherlock Holmes model, because even though Sherlock Holmes teases Watson from time to time, but Watson is really a stand-in for the reader, whereas Christie is asking us to mock Hastings. And what is more modern than mocking, right? So it laces the books with irony, and she does this from right out the gate, right in Styles. Yeah. And that's the kind of, this is not James Joyce writing in 18 languages, being, you know, like just sort of throwing us head first into the abyss of, oh my God, what am I reading? This is a much more gentle sort of, you know, modern, conservative modernity. Those are the sorts of things that she's doing. And I think you get so, to a certain extent, you get so much farther and you have such a wider reach when you're doing things like that, but you're getting at some of the same things that the modernists were doing, just in a much more bombastic way.
Well, I wouldn't use the word bombastic because I wouldn't want to live without Kafka and Thomas Mann and Virginia Woolf. Let's not pit them against each other. Because one of the problems I had when I was, this became my PhD, although I started off working on contemporary women's writing and then ended up going backwards in time. But, you know, one of the problems was precisely that, you know, that literary criticism was divided up. There was either high culture, which could be analysed and criticised and taken seriously, or this other stuff. And it seems such a withered kind of way of thinking about a culture as a whole. And, you know, you wouldn't look at Elizabethan culture or other periods in your own history without looking across the whole range of things that human beings could create and produce. Everything, you know, from a quilt to a painting. So I guess I would resist pitting them against each other, but you're right. She has a very deft touch, and she learnt very quickly, which I think I say, you know, not to patronise her reader. She was very good at not expressing prejudices and often giving some of the most obnoxious prejudices, some of the racist remarks that are in the book, are given to really unpleasant people. You know, they're not the narrator. And generally, the foreigners are not the murderers. And I believe I'm right in saying that no servant is ever a murderer, which isn't true, you know, of Dorothy Alstayers or Marjorie Allingham. You know, that she has a very, from the beginning, you know, from the get-go, she has this real sense of her reader as someone to respect. And I think that's also what's carried her through beyond her moment, which was a long moment, but, you know, into another 50 or 60 years, way beyond that, you know.
Yeah, there is a Miss Marple short story that takes place exclusively among the working classes. So the murderer in that one is working class, but because you do make that statement in your book in Forever.
Which one is it?
It's called Death by Drowning. Mm-hmm. And it's an outlier of a piece. It's within the 13 Problems collection, and it's very much an outlier both as to form and even the fact that it's entirely among the working classes. But I believe you're right. Yeah, I mean, she certainly features servants as important characters. You know, we always talk about don't underestimate the help. That's kind of a Christie precept when you're breaking down these puzzles. But at the end of it, it's not that one of the servant classes is actually the murderer. I believe that's true. I'll have to think more about that, but that is very interesting. And I also love the comparison you make in your book to not just Christie and P.G. Woodhouse, but Christie and Noel Coward in that way.
Yes.
Because that was also what he was able to do. And that is such an apt comparison, because I think if you do read Christie closely, you can absolutely see the ways in which they are very similar.
Soul siblings. Yes, well, they both capture that lightness, really, and that love of youth, which I think kind of infuses the 20s and into the 30s to some extent. You know, I mean, like in Private Lives, when one of the characters, Elliot, declaims, you know, let's be superficial. You know, that's what we want. We don't want to be stuffy old Victorians. We want to have fun. You know, we want to kick up our heels. I think the kind of comedies that were doing the rounds in the West End in London in the period, you know, were things that spoke to Christie, even though she didn't write in that style. But, you know, she gathered something of it, I think.
And she experimented too, right? Like any modernist, you know, you talk about the fact that as you're reading through the mixed bag of books from the 1920s, you know, the thrillers, the short stories, and the puzzle mysteries that she does, you can see that she's experimenting with form, thinking, okay, what am I good at? What is going to be, you know?
And also that, as with all writers, the process of doing that experimenting is how she discovers what she's good at.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and what works, what's new, what her own take is, because there are so many hangovers, as you say, in the early books, some of which are really atrocious, you know, in Mysterious Affair at Styles. I mean, I talk about the fact that, you know, it's absolutely jam-packed with clues and paraphernalia and a map of the house. You know, these are all sort of old plot devices. But still in it, as you were saying, there's something new bubbling through with the relationship between Poirot and Hastings, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
There's something that's trying to get through. I mean, I think it's almost like she doesn't get there till after she's stopped trying to be a wife to her first husband. But no doubt Lucy Worsley's new biography will give us a different, you know, view of how the life and the work relate. Most of my biographical comments in Forever England are in the footnotes, I noticed. You know, it wasn't quite respectable to bring biography into a book of literary criticism. You know, it was bad enough that I was talking about Agatha Christie and Daphne du Maurier.
Right.
You know, they're sort of mini biographies, but they're dotted about in the chapters. So I look forward to seeing those related a bit more firmly and intimately.
We've gotten more comfortable, I think, with inserting biographical analysis into literary analysis.
Not reducing it to that. You know.
You can. I think you can use it. You just have to use it intelligently. You know, and because it is important and illuminating, but it's not. It's obviously not everything. No one wants to be reduced to their life circumstances, especially when they're a writer. That's usually why they're writing in the first place, right?
Yeah, and Christie worked very hard to keep herself out of, in a way, not to reveal herself. I mean, you know, as you know, the autobiography is one of the most unrevealing autobiographies that's possible to write, really.
Oh my God. And Come Tell Me How You Live as well. I mean, they're both just so closed off as to. You do write, I defy anyone now to enjoy The Big Four, which I appreciated, because the Big Four is our second lowest ranked book. Oh, and actually our lowest is The Secret of Chimneys, which is another 20s thriller.
But you know, she's an apprentice if anybody listening, is a writer or has written poems in their youth, you probably don't want them to be, you know, to be taken as the very first things you've written, to be taken as, you know, your kind of, your best work. You know, she's learning and she's inventing. I mean, that's the other thing that is easy to forget because we look back with hindsight. She actually invents a way of doing this, really. There isn't anybody else like her writing in that manner. So, you know, someone like Sayers, Allingham, hundreds of other detective writers in the period, they're all much more recognizably alike in the things they do.
I agreed. And I think that is why Christie's lasted, because she was doing something different and something particular, something unique. But it also makes her very difficult to evaluate, and it's why my co-host Catherine and I, why we started this project in the first place, because she's tricky to evaluate as a writer, and it really is because of this conservative modernity, I think, because if you evaluate her purely along naturalistic lines, right, as a Victorian or Edwardian writer who's just fully grounded in creating realist literature, well, then she's a failure. She's a total failure, because that's not what she's doing. But, you know, if you evaluate her along entirely modernistic or postmodern lines, that's a failure too, because she's doing something different while pulling from those traditions as well. So that's why I think, you know, we do have categories such as characterization and evocation of setting, because she is doing those traditional things, but then she's also doing something different. So it's just tricky, which is why it's interesting and fruitful for discussion to, I think, evaluate her and figure out what she's doing and how she's doing it. And I just think you go a long way toward explicating that, you know, within 60 pages in your book, which is fascinating. Well, I feel like I should probably let you go, because I'm sure you have to do a whole bunch of things. But I did just have to ask, because you already referenced the fact that you read Christie as a teenager. And I was just curious if you have, because I always have to ask anyone I interview this, do you have a favorite Christie, a favorite title?
Well, I think there are so many, really. I think that And Then There Were None, which is the English title for Ten Little Indians, which was written in 1939, is an astonishing book, actually. It's one of her more serious books. I'm worried about giving away things, but I imagine most people know the plots by now.
Yes, fast forward if you haven't read And Then There Were None, which I'm pretty sure will be zero of you, but please continue.
Yes. Well, you know, it's a story which is set on an island. The characters, the main protagonists, are all invited, who seem perfectly nice people, and they think they're getting a free holiday. And, you know, it turns out that every one of them is a murderer, and everyone is a victim, you know, becomes murdered until there's nobody left on the island. I think that's a great feat of imagination at the more gothic end, if you like, of her writing, and a sort of picture of what happens to people who become very isolated, you know, in their thinking, which is one, and feel no remorse, which it looks forward, if you like, to people like Patricia Highsmith and Ripley and those other kinds of thrillers, psychological thrillers. But I still love all the Poirot. I don't think I can choose a favourite, Kemper. You know, it's funny. I mean, I'm still a fan, you know, despite all the criticism. I think The Murder of Roger Ackroyd is amazing, actually, too, when I reread that. And I have a soft spot for one or two of the Marples, you know, like at Bertram's Hotel, which is another one which is wholly about England as a kind of facade.
Absolutely. Yeah, no, I think you make the point, And Then There Were None is almost like the pinnacle of that anxiety, right, within the middle classes, and the uncertainty over who we are and what's going to happen, because it does not end well, as we all know.
Has it actually been filmed? I think it's probably very difficult to film for that reason.
Oh, And Then There Were None has been filmed a number of times. Yeah. But the more recent BBC Sarah Phelps version, I think that's one of the more successful of the Sarah Phelps. There are some interesting choices made.
Makes sense.
But yeah, it's we did a review of the Major and then There Were None adaptations down the years, and they're all, you know, emphasizing different things, doing something different, and that's what we, I think, have to expect of any adaptation of Christie, or I suppose any text, because they're just not going to do the same thing that the text is doing, because they're not a text. So,
well, I tell you, the other novel that I've reread, I mean, I've reread hers, but I've put them to one side now because I just know them too well. But I think the ABC Murders is a favourite.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's a wonderful plot, and it's also a very humane book. You know, it's her at her most open-minded, really, too, about, you know, the sordid shopkeeper murder. Mm-hmm. You know, that's a very good one, I think, too.
I think you say that it excels at Graham Greenish seediness
in
Forever England, which is so true. And I believe you quote the passage, which is very affecting, when they're looking at the belongings of Alice Asher, who is the shopwoman. And Poirot says, you know, poor woman, pauvre femme, right? That's his. And you say, one could only imagine what Lord Peter Wimsey would have had to say about, because it would have been very different. That just sort of shows up the differences, I think, between Sayers and Christie. It's illuminating. Yeah. But
we must stop. Yes,
we should stop. And I was going to force you to choose between Poirot and Marple, but you've, I think, sort of anticipated that question.
No,
and,
I don't think I will.
I don't think you will, and I don't think you have to. You certainly focus more on Poirot in Forever England, but that's really because you're focusing on the 30s, and you know, as we know, she didn't write as much Marple then. But we could obviously cover so much more, because you cover so much more in your book, but I think we'll leave it there. And I would encourage any interested listeners to check out both the 1991 book, Forever England, Femininity, Literature, and Conservatism Between the Wars, and then also your new book of essays, Inside History, From Popular Fiction to Life Writing. And do we know when that paperback will be out of that book?
Well, it's been released, or is being released, as an e-book, which is a lot cheaper, through Edinburgh University Press. The paperback ought to be out in a year or so. And, you know, the publishers promised me that it'll be under 30 quid on this side, which with discounts mean it comes down to a reasonable price, hopefully, you know, within the year. Who knows?
Yes.
Never believe what publishers tell you. That's my motto.
Well, thank you so much, Alison, both for your work and for talking with me today.
It's been a pleasure, Kemper.
It was really gratifying to be able to speak with Alison Light, not only because she is such an early and foundational scholar of Christie, but also because the insights in her book, Forever England, as to Christie, and beyond Christie for that matter, if anyone wants to read her other chapters, they're all brilliant. But those insights are just so important, and I think have contributed so significantly to where we are in our present day when it comes to Agatha Christie scholarship. Not that there isn't a lot more work to do, because there's always more work to do and more discussions to be had, and I hope to be having some, if not many, of them. But thank you again to Alison Light. That was just a fantastic conversation. And I enjoyed speaking with her so much that I am actually bringing you another interview episode for the next episode on the podcast in 2 weeks' time. I will actually be speaking with Carla Valentine, who wrote a fantastic book that came out very recently in the UK and is just about due to come out in the US. It is called Murder Isn't Easy, The Forensics of Agatha Christie. In the US, it's actually called The Science of Murder, The Forensics of Agatha Christie. And we do talk at great length about that title change. Have no fear. Carla is a big friend of the podcast, and Catherine and I actually had been looking forward to having her on for quite some time. So it was lovely to finally have her on, though of course I wish I could have done so along with Catherine, but that goes for everything that I'm doing these days on the podcast. And I can't wait to bring you that conversation. And then the episode after that will be our third to last Christie novel. That would be Postern of Fate, the final Tommy and Tuppence novel. And my co-host for that episode will be Caroline Crampton of She Done It, fame. And if you have not yet checked out the She Done It podcast, please do yourself a massive favor and go check it out right now. It is available wherever you are listening to this podcast. And it is brilliant, and it is made for you. If you are a listener of All About Agatha, you are practically guaranteed to love Caroline's podcast, which again is called She Done It, S-H-E-D-U-N-N-I-T. Yes, we all do see what she did there with the title, and that is an accurate indication of how clever and erudite and illuminating she is as to the mystery genre overall. She talks a whole lot about Agatha Christie, but she also talks about a lot of other writers, many of whom have come up from time to time on this podcast. So again, check out She Done It if you want to do a little bit of homework before our Caroline Crampton co-hosted episode. So excited to have her on. So excited to have Carla Valentine on before that. And in the meantime, if you need even more content, you can always head on over to the podcast's Patreon site. I've included a link in the notes for this episode. The URL is www.patreon.com, P-A-T-R-E-O-N, / All About Agatha. You can always email me at allaboutthedame@gmail.com. You can find the podcast on Twitter at All About The Dame and on Instagram at All About Agatha. And I really would appreciate it if you would take a moment to give the podcast a rating and or a review. It's just a nice thing to do, no matter what you say in the review and how many stars you give me. Although, you know, I'd love for you to give me a lot of stars if possible. All right, see you next time. Bye.